Hi, everybody. Today's Tuesday, July 22nd, 2025, and our friend Scott Ritter is back with us. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start, Scott, with what has happened with the case of Ukraine. It seems that the United States, as time goes by, is considering sanctions on Brazil, China, and India, and to bring some sort of pressure on Russia. Here is what Lindsey Graham said, Scott, on Fox News.
China, India, and Brazil. If you keep buying cheap Russian oil to allow this war to continue, we're going to tariff the hell out of you, and we're going to crush your economy, because what you're doing is blood money. You're buying cheap Russian oil at the expense of the world, and President Trump is tired of this game. If I were President Putin, I would get to the table soon, because he's about to get crushed.
You know, it's what's so tragic. During the Biden administration, we have to follow Lindsey Graham, because what he somehow, his policy were the official policy in Washington. It seems that for the Trump administration, it turns to be the same case. He's leading what's going on in Washington.
You know, I mean, we're talking about domestic politics right now. And, you know, there's a tremendous amount of anti-Russian sentiment in the United States, and it's politically easy to beat up on Vladimir Putin in Russia. But we're also, you have to understand that Lindsey Graham, and I think it was Blumenthal, the senator from Connecticut, you know, were posturing for 500% tariffs to be placed on these nations, India, Russia, Brazil, and to be done immediately. I mean, you know, Lindsey Graham went and you know, sat with Zelensky and the Ukrainian government to work this out. And yet what the president has done is said, you know, pass your bill, but you have to give me complete control over this. I get to determine when, how much, and how to lift it. Congress has no say in this. So all Lindsey Graham did is create a talking point. There's no real policy here, none that obligates the president to do anything. The president has said he's going to wait 50 days and give Russia the time to, what, reconsider its actions. But at the same time, we have Seymour Hersh writing in his Substack that the Trump administration is seeking to remove Zelensky from power. Zelensky, the man who met with Senator Graham to come up with this grand sanctioning idea. You know, the moment that this was announced, the sanctions and the European sanctions were announced, the Russian stock market went up 2.7%. Russians aren't worried about this. They're not afraid of this. China's already said that they won't yield, that they'll use whatever resources they have to strike back. Brazil has said, if you don't want to do business with us, then we won't do business with you. You know, India is the weak link, but India has to be careful, because they could find themselves on the losing side of a supply chain war with China. And that would crush the Indian economy. The United States isn't willing to step up right now and bail India out of any economic problems it gets into, because it blindly follows American diktat. So, you know, there's no guarantee that India will do this, but there's also no guarantee that Trump's going to do this. Lindsey Graham doesn't have any decision-making capabilities. He's one senator in a United States Senate that has already punted to this president. The only decision-making authority is with the president. It appears that the president is simply using Lindsey Graham's tariff threat as a political shield behind which to hide the fact that they have no real policy regarding Russia, and to buy time for them to, you know, try and shape the battlefield, so to speak. I think they want Zelensky gone. They need him removed, and they want to replace him with somebody that, you know, might be able to make the concessions necessary to get the Russians to the negotiating table. Zelensky's afraid of this. Look, at all of a sudden Zelensky wants to talk to Russia now. I'm the guy that can talk to Russia. Russia won't talk to him. Zelensky's history. I don't think Zelensky's going to be the guy, but that's a different, you know, different issue altogether. But, you know, you're talking about these sanctions and the threat of sanctions. This is just Lindsey Graham being Lindsey Graham, the world's dumbest man when it comes to all things Russia.
I think it was last week that Mertz said that we're going to support you till the end. We're going to be with you. He meant that he was talking about Ukraine or Zelensky, in your opinion?
I don't know. I mean, Mertz is all over the place. It seems that he and his, those in the German government who share his philosophies have tied themselves to Ukraine as sort of the locomotive that's going to pull them through the current problems. You know, the Russians have pointed out that when we speak of Germany, we're speaking of a nation that is deindustrializing as we speak. Their economy is collapsing. They have an energy crisis. And they're politically divided. I mean, they're about ready to step into literal, dictatorship. The second largest party in Germany, Alternative for Deutschland, could very well become illegal, outlawed. Is this really what a democracy does? Merz, when he speaks, you have to keep in mind that he is not the strongest chancellor Germany's ever had, and his government is a fragile government that could very well collapse if its policies are challenged effectively. So what he's done with Ukraine is buy into a policy that allows him to wrap himself in the European Union flag, and he's trying to wrap himself in the American flag as well to say that this is a common cause, a united cause, a just cause around which we must rally and make sacrifices, and then use the concept of sacrifices as the excuse for failed policy. But I don't think Merz is going to survive much longer. I think the German economy is checking out as we speak, and at some point in time, one can only hope that rational thinking takes hold in Germany, and they evict these people like Merz and others who are willing to sacrifice the German nation for a Eurocentric cause that is not viable, not linked to reality.
You mentioned 50 days that Donald Trump has some sort of deadline for Russia, but with what's going on the battlefield, what is, when you look at the way that Russia is going on the battlefield, what is the strategy on their part, in your opinion, when you look at the scene?
What is the Russian strategy?
Russian strategy.
To win?
But is that mean that they're going to escalate? They're going to go on?
Why would they escalate? Russia's not tied to 50 days. Russia's not tied to any calendar. There's no calendar pressure on Russia whatsoever. Russia is just going to win, which means every day the commanders get up and deploy their forces, and their goal is to kill as many Ukrainians and push the Ukrainians back as far as they can be pushed that day without putting too many Russian lives at risk. On the strategic front, it appears that Russia has made a decision that they're going to do a full court press on attacking Ukrainian infrastructure and military targets. There's not going to be a period of time where Ukrainian cities get to go weeks without any Russian activity. The Russian intelligence coverage over Ukraine appears to be very tight, meaning when they detect movement, they strike. And they're right now in the business of striking. Every day, 400, 500, 600 drones fly in. There's nothing to shoot them down. Then they're followed by precision strike weapons. There's nothing that can shoot them down either. And the Russians are just grinding Ukraine away. And they will continue to do this until Ukraine no longer exists or the Ukraine accepts surrender on Russia's terms.
Do you feel that any time in the near future or maybe during these days, Poland gonna get involved because they're asking their citizens to leave Russia? And what is the role of Poland at this point?
Sorry.
Because are they gonna Why are they asking this if nothing's happening behind the scenes?
The Poles may know something about what's going on inside Ukraine. Seymour Hersh believes that Zelensky will either be thrown into exile or be compelled to leave internally or externally. But then there's the question of what comes after that. There may be a period of uncertainty, and the Poles may have an understanding that this could lead to some sort of civil breakdown and maybe civil conflict, and they're asking their citizens to leave. It's laughable to think of the Polish military intervening. The Poles acknowledge themselves to run out of ammunition in 14 days. So why would you want to intervene only to run out of ammunition in 14 days and intervene with what? They don't have an offensively inclined military. They could begin crossing the border into Western Ukraine. But almost immediately they'd be engaged by forces coming out of Belarus, and they wouldn't be able to handle that. The Russians believe in the counterattack. So if Poland begins cross-border operations from Poland into Belarus, that's the end of Warsaw. It will fall. The Polish army can't defend. They can't fight. The Poles know this. The generals know this. They're not going to get involved in a fight. I think Poland is taking a look at the deteriorating situation inside Ukraine and making the decision to get the Polish, get Polish citizens out of harm's way.
You've mentioned Zelensky may be the case in the mind of those people in the West. We know Zelensky was, we were talking actually, I was asking you before, I think 6 months ago, if Zelensky would be the case, because it seems that the British government, the British intelligence, they've been preparing him for this position. Is that going to be acceptable for the case of Ukraine? And who's going to guarantee that he's going to be a better option for Ukraine and he's going to change anything in Ukraine?
Look, the British and the Americans and NATO continue to operate as if they matter, as if their opinion counts when it comes to the future of Ukraine. Russia's sort of on record that it doesn't matter. It doesn't count. Russia alone will pick the future leader of Ukraine. Russia would prefer to do that. They're willing to allow an interim leader to be picked using elections, but the elections only serve to eliminate the illegitimate President Zelensky and replace him with somebody that constitutionally is capable of accepting the terms of surrender. This is why the Russians don't say surrender then elections. They say elections and then surrender, because they need Zelensky gone. Zelensky, I don't think he's an attractive candidate. I don't think I can't speak for the Russians, but I mean, this is a man who took a selfie with Stepan Bandera's photograph behind him. If you're talking about denazification, there's a Nazi right there. So Zelensky's future is probably a bullet in the back of his head, as opposed to the presidency of Ukraine. He would be best advised to stay in the United Kingdom and not seek to return to Ukraine. He was the commander of Ukrainian forces when many crimes were committed against Russian soldiers and Russian civilians. So I would imagine that he's high on a list of those people who will be held to account by the Russians in a post-conflict environment. The Russians right now, again, I can't speak for them because I'm not privy, but when you take a look at what's going on, the Russians do have something called the Union State. And that is it's a political and economic relationship between Belarus and Russia. And the Union State right now is very active in talking about the future of Ukraine, because I think the vision for Russia is that post-conflict Ukraine, once it's been denazified and normalcy brought in, will become part of the Union State, that they will join the same political and economic union as Belarus and the Russian Federation. This means that there's no EU. It means that there's no British appointed leaders. There's no American control of Ukrainian rare earth minerals. All of that is garbage. This is the reality. The West just hasn't woken up to this fact. And the Russians, they're in no hurry. They're in no hurry. Sanctions won't work. There's no military pressure that can be put on Russia in a meaningful fashion. NATO, the more NATO tries to posture and position itself as militarily relevant, the weaker they get. I liken NATO to, if you go out and buy there's a house down the road that was abandoned by its owners, I guess a year and a half ago. And it was, overgrown. The lawn wasn't mowed, trees weren't cut back, bushes weren't cut back. And, it's just a mess. Somebody bought it and now they're in the process of renovating it, but those things sometimes have the nickname, the money pit, meaning that you bought it and you're just pouring more money into it. And, Ukraine is a money pit. I mean, it's a mess. The West and NATO is a money pit. NATO, the more NATO tries to, modernize itself, the more you're sometimes it's just best to sell the old car and not try to modernize it and just buy a new car. And NATO probably should be dissolved, and Europe rethink what they need, because right now to bring in NATO, you're bringing in legacy structures and institutions and ways of thinking that just don't make any sense. Europe needs to think about European defense. Not becoming a, continuing this 1990s, early 2000s fantasy of being a springboard of American hegemonistic imperialism. And NATO's problematic across the board. And I don't think Russia has anything to worry about from NATO.
Is NATO without the United States, or maybe shall I put it this way? Can NATO survive without the United States?
No.
Is it just militarily or politically they cannot survive as well?
Both. Without the United States, NATO will fracture into, at a minimum, two different schools of thought, more likely three different schools of thought. You'll have the big power school of thought, the British, the French, and the Germans. Thinking that they can dictate the future of NATO. Italy would like to be a member of that club, but it won't. So Italy instead become the leader of the other Western aligned powers, France, Portugal, Italy, et cetera. Belgium, Netherlands, Denmark. These will be people that will be trying to prevent the French, the Germans, and the British dictating things. But then there's the Eastern Bloc nations, plus the two new nations, Finland and Sweden, which consider themselves to be frontline states, and they'll have their own position. And the West isn't willing to back up the East. They're not going to let the East dictate terms of coexistence, meaning the East says we have to be positioned to go to war against Russia. The West, I think, will say, well, no, we need to be positioned to defend ourselves, and we'll plan accordingly. So you'll have three different schools of thought in NATO splitting apart, unless you have Daddy there. I mean, here's where Mark Rutte was correct. Daddy has to come in and bap, 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 line up. This is what we're going to do. Without America, NATO just falls apart, and NATO can't afford it. They can't sustain it. There'll be no discipline. There'll be nothing, just a bunch of bickering children. That's the future of NATO, which is why, as I said before, it's probably best just to get rid of NATO, kick the United States out of Europe, and deal with European security issues on their own.
You mean that the security issues would be the pact that the kind of that they had between the United Kingdom and Germany, a military pact between two countries, three countries among them, or something like that? They're going to make some sort of bilateral and trilateral accords between the countries in Europe, or how does that work for them?
That would be suicidal, because now what you've done is made the haves and the have-nots in Europe. I think if they're going to succeed, they need to have a European Union defense agreement. But the problem is the European Union itself is not viable. It's falling apart. So at the end of the day, I think the best thing for Europe is, first of all, to seek normalized relations with Russia, and understand that rather than a traditional military alliance, what they should have is a military committee that just seeks to resolve issues in a non-military manner. Europe needs to demilitarize. There's no reason to have large standing ground armies in Europe nowadays. What's the purpose? Are they going to invade Africa? Are they going to invade the Middle East? Do they really want to go to war against Russia? What's the purpose of a large ground army? What will happen if Europe has large ground armies is that Europe will go to war against Europe. You'll get these smaller organizations, and you'll see. I mean, you already see it happening right now where Croatia, Albania, and Kosovo are coming together with a military alliance, and they're being countered by Serbia, Hungary, and Slovakia. You know, these are mini NATO alliances within the NATO alliance, each of which incorporate non-NATO membership. And they're doing this because they fear one another and the potential of war. So this is the future of NATO. NATO will break up into different blocks. And then they'll go to war against each other. So Europe's best bet is to start taking the military out of European consideration. You don't need to have a large defense industry. You know, what you need to have is a viable civilian industry that keeps people gainfully employed, then use your collective economic strength as a way of engendering prosperity, peace, etc., especially with Russia, which really doesn't want to have a large standing army itself, would prefer to have a smaller army and spend more time focusing on, you know, the things that are important to them. So we'll see. I just think Europe's in a lot of trouble right now, a very dysfunctional continent.
Scott, when I look at the European Union, it seems that what has happened to Europe in the aftermath of creation of this union and how the United States was playing a role in the whole situation there, it somehow didn't let them to grow up. They don't know how to deal with their issues without the United States. And it seems to be the case, especially right now with the case of Ukraine. Without the United States, they don't know how to deal with their problems. Is that gonna? Do you think that the disintegration of European Union would somehow let them to grow up to somehow being more sane, more objective toward their goals, toward their future?
Well, I mean, you have children, right? You're a parent. How do you encourage your children to grow up? There's a period of time where you have to provide security for them, provide a home, provide food, provide, you know, shelter, safety. But at some point in time, the children reach the age of maturity and you expect them to go out on their own. You do what you can to prepare them for that moment, but they go out. But if at that moment you instead convert your basement into a home where they are allowed to stay and you say, don't worry about getting a job, I will continue to give you an allowance and I will pay for everything. And you do that for 30 years. Next thing you know, you got a 50-year-old kid living in your basement who's incapable of operating on their own. That's Europe. Europe at the end of the Second World War became almost totally subordinated to the United States. The Marshall Plan, impacted Europe economically and, as by an extension, politically. Europe never matured as a continent, as a people. They were always under the control of the United States, or at least the influence. It's not that the United States was aggressive in its assertion of control, although if you take a look at the 1950s and 60s, the CIA's effort to bring down the Communist Party in Italy and in France, etc., you know, we definitely wanted to shape events so that, you know, the governments there would be easily, more readily controlled by the United States. But Europe did this willingly. They allowed themselves to become that 50-year-old kid in the basement of their parents' house, and that's where they are today. They've never matured. They've never grown up. They don't know how to. They don't know what to do without daddy. They don't know how to behave. They can't make their own decisions. You know, let's look at, you know, the European Union itself is, you know, look economically. It's pretty much subordinated to the G7. And the G7 is dominated by the United States. They don't make decisions independent of the G7. The G7 is a control mechanism used by the United States to control Europe, and our major Western oriented Asian powers, Japan and South Korea. You know, Europe in terms of security is you know, linked to NATO, and NATO is dominated by the United States. I mean, literally, Europe is an adult child that's never been allowed to grow up. It doesn't know how to function. They can throw a temper tantrum. You know, I mean, it's again, I mean, I take a look at France, Germany, and the United Kingdom now, you know, getting together and we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do this. Well, that's a lot like the 50-year-old kid getting together with his friends in a bar saying, I'm going to declare independence. I'm going to go off and do this. Meanwhile, he's buying beer with the money that daddy gave him to buy beer, and he's going to get back in his car and drive home in the car that mommy bought him, and he's going to go back and living in the basement of the parents' house. There's nothing serious about Europe nowadays. Literally, they're not adults. They're children pretending to be adults. And if the United States actually pulled the plug, they would collapse and wouldn't know what to do.
Did you watch the interview that Tucker Carlson had with the German journalist? He was asking him, what's happening to Germany? Because I think Germany's case is the worst case. You see some sort of sovereignty in Italy, in France, but when it comes to Germany, they're totally, you don't see the leadership. You don't see the somehow standing for their benefit. And What has happened to Germany? Why they're so much hesitant to express what they're feeling, what would be their benefit? And it seems that you look at them somehow, there's all the leadership, the people who are somehow running the mainstream media in Germany, they're so numb. You don't feel that they have something to say for the benefit of German people, for the benefit of Germany and future of Germany.
Well, the Germans have for so long forgotten what it means to be German and instead focused on what they thought they had become, which is the largest, most powerful bank of Europe. You know, it's superficial to say this, but I'll say it anyways. I don't think the Germans love being German. In fact, I think a lot of Germans resent being German for a number of reasons. And they're posturing in a way that they believe the United States wants them to posture. And this is dangerous. It's dangerous not only for Germany in terms of, the lack of sovereignty. The fact that, I mean, remember, Olaf Scholz stood in the White House while Joe Biden threatened to blow up the Nord Stream pipeline. It didn't say a word. I mean, my God, if I were a German leader, I would have put my fist down on the table and said, you will never do that. If you do that, it's an act of war. I mean, we will literally take over the bases, capture all your personnel, and declare war on you. You will not attack Germany. Germany alone makes a decision about its energy policy and its major energy infrastructure. If you have concerns, you can come and talk to me. I was just here, but you don't get to stand up and tell the world you're going to attack a major piece of German infrastructure and expect me to be silent. That would have been a German leader. Instead, Scholz was silent. Why? Because Germany doesn't know how to behave without American leadership. Now, you take a look at Germany and the things that they're doing, from a militaristic standpoint. And people say, well, Scott, so you keep talking about the Fourth Reich and the emergence of the Fourth Reich. Isn't that Germany acting out on its own? No, you guys don't know German history if that's what you believe. The Fourth Reich was born in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, where the United States began the process of whitewashing the German crimes of the Second World War so that they could have this large pool of German military manpower ready to be mobilized to take on the Soviet Union. The whole whitewashing scheme goes back to Nuremberg. Yes, there were people who got there, but it was Eisenhower himself, together with Donovan, that encouraged German generals to begin rewriting the history of the Second World War. One of them, Seidel, wrote a book about the Normandy invasion, 1944, and it showed that the Germans were noble soldiers, had nothing to do with the Nazis, just fighting this war, as professional soldiers do. Seidel was arrested and put on trial together with a dozen other German generals for committing, you know, war crimes, mass murder. Hundreds of thousands of civilians died under his watch while in areas of Europe that he occupied. He was found guilty, sentenced to 20 years in jail. But he was released by John McCloy, Truman's man who came in and took over, you know, the occupation of Germany and basically freed all the Nazi generals and then oversaw the incorporation of Germany into NATO and the creation of the modern day Bundeswehr, which was commanded by Nazi generals and it comprised a lot of former Wehrmacht soldiers. And the Bundeswehr, together with the BND, German Intelligence Service, which simply incorporated General Galen's Eastern Intelligence Organization that was set up against the Russians, against the Soviets, to include their operatives inside Ukraine that were working with the Banderists. The CIA took that over and ran it for a decade. We ran operations using Nazis to coordinate with Nazis to resist the Russians. And so the Germans, they've been conditioned for two things. One, to be subordinated to the United States, and two, to whitewash their Nazi past and encourage that kind of posturing because they believe that's what the United States wants. It's very dangerous, a very dangerous thing to be, you know, going back to behaviors that were reprehensible the first time around. And Germany expects the world not to be repulsed by it the second time around. When you have a German chancellor talking about how they won't make the same mistake, well, what mistake did you make in World War II? I would hope you believe the same mistake is you won't ever again engage in an illegal war of aggression and reflect back on the one Nuremberg trial, which had meaning, which was the first one where Judge Jackson, the prosecutor, and worked with the other judges to find that war of aggression was the ultimate war crime because from the war of aggression, all other crimes take place. And yet Germany seems to believe right now that it can carry out a war of aggression against Russia and somehow the United States will tolerate this, that it's okay. Does Germany want Lebensraum now? You know, do they want to go in and move to the Ural Mountains and take all the Russians that live west of the Ural Mountains and kill them and enslave everybody else so the Germans can live back to their World War II ambition of having vacation homes in Crimea, where you have Russian slaves serving them. I mean, that's what they did. We're not going to make the same mistake, Mertz said. Well, yes, you are. You're making the exact same mistake. But I don't know what's going on in Germany. It's a dysfunctional nation. Truly is a dysfunctional nation. And increasingly, it's becoming a nation that if it's not brought under control by the German people, will be a nation that, I've often likened Ukraine to a rabid dog that needs to be shot, taking a cue out of, To Kill a Mockingbird in the role play by Atticus Finch, and shooting a rabid dog that was terrorizing the streets of the town. Germany's about to become a rabid dog too. And maybe we need an American Atticus Finch to put the German rabid dog down once and for all, because the third time's a charm. Germany's already done this a couple times. They shouldn't be allowed to do it again.
Do you see the United States moving toward some sort of talks, direct talk with Russia? Because
we're in direct talks.
No, but they're somehow putting Ukraine on the table. They're trying to let Ukraine be on the table to talk with Russians, but when we're going to have the three parties, I'm talking about the United States together with Ukraine on one side and Russia on the other side, that would somehow facilitate.
Never. What right does the United States
have? You mean the main barrier would be Zelensky and his administration?
No, the main barrier is Russia. Why would Russia give the United States that power? What has the United States done to earn that power? I mean, Russia's not going to complicate things. Russia's made it clear what their goals and objectives are. And it's an issue of Ukraine and Russia's relationship with Ukraine, not of the United States suddenly stepping in after, it's just like the arsonist sets the building on fire. And then when the fire department comes, says, I'll tell you how to fight the fire. No, you set it on fire. Get the hell out of the way. The United States set Ukraine on fire. So why do they now get to come to the table and start dictating anything? The United States is in no position to dictate. And I don't think Russia is in the business of listening to America dictate. What Russia would like to do is work through Ukraine to get to the other issues that they should be discussing with the United States. You know, strategic arms reduction, the resumption of economic benefits, the normalization of diplomatic relations. These are things that should be discussed. But Ukraine, Russia's already made it clear what their Ukrainian position is. And that's what's frustrating to Trump is that, you know, he's confronted now with the reality that Russia is not listening to him because he doesn't matter. He's irrelevant, especially when you try, you know, what are Trump's real motivations here? He wants credit for stopping the war. Why? What's his the Nobel Peace Prize? Of course, that's what he wants. He always talks about it. Is that really your motivation for stopping this? Means that it's all about Trump and it's not about the reality of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Then to stop this war in a way that gives him some sort of advantage. Well, the Russians are tired of that game. They're tired of entering negotiations with the United States that the United States uses just to retain advantage over the Russians. Russia didn't start this war, but Russia will finish this war on terms that are acceptable to Russia. And that's the reality the United States has to say. I don't believe there will ever be three-party negotiations. I think at the end of the day, Ukraine surrenders to Russia, and that's it.
But the security architecture, I think what Russia wants from the conflict in Ukraine, for any sort of settlement happening to the conflict in Ukraine, is the security architecture of the region, which would be Europe and together with Russia. Is Donald Trump prepared to facilitate that process? Do you see that coming in the Trump administration?
The problem is I don't think the Trump administration knows what it wants for a European security infrastructure. On the one hand, Trump has talked about how NATO is a leech sucking the life out of America and America needs to disentangle itself from Europe. And then he turns around because he's mad at Putin. And now he's talking about, you know, America, you know, getting back into the game in Europe. But then the way we get back into the game is just insulting to the Europeans. We get back in the game not by putting up America's economic resources and military resources and diplomatic resources, but is the way that a grifter does. Buy the weapon twice. That's what we're telling Europe. Hey, you already bought one of those Patriots from us. Give it to the Ukrainians and buy another one to replace it. And that's our contribution to the war. It's a scam. It's a grift. It's a con. Which means he's not serious. And so I think at some point in time, once you remove Ukraine from the equation, Donald Trump will be politically empowered to start making decisions that make sense for the United States. And one of those decisions will be, I think, to move to improve relations with Ukraine and get the United States out of the NATO entanglement. But right now, because Ukraine has become a political hot potato for the president because of his inability to stop the war and therefore seeking to blame Vladimir Putin. He's trapped. He's in the NATO trap. But long term, I don't think neither he nor his like-minded people want to stay in the NATO trap forever. I think that, J.D. Vance, potential future president of the United States, isn't enthralled about either Europe or NATO.
The problem is, in my opinion, the United Kingdom would not let Ukraine to get out of the equation.
How do they stop it?
They're just preparing everything.
But they got nothing.
Zeluzhny going to be in power?
Zeluzhny's one man. He's a corrupt Ukrainian general resident in the United Kingdom right now, whose only power comes from the British press.
Do you really believe what has happened to the Russian nuclear bombers was somehow the United States? I don't believe it was the United States.
No, it was the British.
It was all cooked up in the Europe.
Said it was the United States. I always said it was the British.
So it shows how important, how seriously they're involved.
They're serious, but Nima, it's a trick play. I mean, do you follow American football?
Yeah.
I like American football. I played it all my life. Can't play anymore because it's a young man's game. But I just know this. When I played in college, and my coach, great guy, classic football guy, Syracuse graduate, played for the Baltimore Colts, and now he's our coach, and he's about the fundamentals. I mean, we blocked, we tackled, and we ran, and we passed, and we focused on. Are we back? Yeah. All right.
You're back, Scott.
Yeah, my internet is goofing up. But the point is, we focus on the fundamentals, and we would practice the fundamentals. And only after we had the fundamentals down did we throw in some trick plays. They would say, okay, you know, this is a special play. We're going to rehearse it a couple times, but we don't spend too much time on it because it's a trick play. And the bottom line is, if it comes down to you have to use a trick play, it means you had problems with the fundamentals, and you need to turn to a trick play. The drone attack against the Russian strategic bombers was a trick play. It's not fundamentals. The Russians are doing the fundamentals on the battlefield. The Russians are doing the fundamentals over the airspace over Ukraine. They're dominating. The Russians are doing the economic fundamentals. All England has is trick plays. You don't win games with trick plays. That's the bottom line. Yeah, you have to take them seriously. But at the end of the day, even when they execute one properly, as they did with the strategic bombers, it doesn't change anything. Actually, it made matters worse because now it caused the Russians to up the ante on their aerial pressure being placed on Zelensky. It's caused the Russians to, you know, maximize production output of their geranium drones and to launch, you know, be prepared to launch up to 1,000 drones a day against Ukraine for a sustained period of time. That's what the trick play got you. Now, I'm not worried about the British. I don't think the Russians are worried about the British either. It doesn't mean you ignore them, but it's not game changer. What do the British have to play, have to offer besides trick plays? I mean, they brought Zelensky in, but Zelensky's run his course. They're trying to position Zelensky, but Zelensky has no domestic base. And at the end of the day, I understand Zelensky's a very corrupt individual, And if he tries to come back into Ukraine and take over, it's only because he wants to make money, and the other corrupt Ukrainians will tear him down. Zelensky won't survive a democratic process. He can't survive. And the Russians will never put up with a man who, you know, poses with Azov veterans while Stepan Bandera is in the background. I mean, he is literally the definition of a Nazi, and therefore he will be denazified. That's the best the British have. Trick play, trick play, trick play. That's it. They don't have fundamentals.
Scott, we had the Iranian foreign minister. He had an interview on Fox News. And how do you find the way that Iranians are somehow trying to communicate with Americans, especially with the Trump administration, in the aftermath of those attacks?
I think they've taken a page out of Vladimir Putin's book, to be honest, where Putin will say, oh, we want to have negotiations. We want to have discussions. We'll sit down at the table, send a team right now to talk to you. But we're not going to change anything we're doing on the battlefield. That's just the reality of the way it is. And I think the Iranians right now are saying, we're willing to talk with the West, with the United States, but we don't trust your negotiations because you screwed us over. So we got to figure that one out. We're willing to work with the IAEA, just not Grossi or the way it's currently configured. We got to work that one out too. I think that's what's happening here. What they're doing is they're making sure all doors are left open, not to provide any excuse for not having a diplomatic off-ramp. But it also appears that they've are very, you know, unified and solidified in their position on, you know, where Iran is and where Iran's going, what Iran will accept. A lot of the decision making now has been taken out of, you know, the hands of the foreign ministry, the presidency, and the Atomic Energy Agency, and put into the Supreme National Security Council. Now the president sits at the head of that. There's no doubt about that, but it's also, there's other major actors in there, and has, you know, it's under sort of the direct supervision of the Supreme Leader and the office of the Supreme Leader. So there's no more room for the the president coming up with an idea and running with it. And then, you know, then you have the Guardian Council review the parliament's decision. Then it goes up to the, what's after that? The Expediency Council, you know, and then maybe the Assembly of Experts will weigh in. And they've swept it clean, Supreme National Security Council. That's it. That's the decision-making body right now. Everything goes through this. And I think that what that's designed to do is eliminate uncertainty within Iran. Because I think you would agree that, you know, there was a split between the presidency and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard in the lead up to this 12-day war. I think what the Iranians have said is we can't allow that split to happen, because what happens is our enemies exploit that split. And so now they're together. There's only one voice, and that's the voice that comes out of the Supreme National Security Council.
We had Ali Larijani. He's so close to the Iranian leader. He went to Russia to talk with Vladimir Putin. It seems that on the Iranian part, on their side, Iranian side, there's so much connected with Russia and China. They know, they communicate, they know what would be the next step on their part. Russia knows, China knows. But on the part of the United States, you don't see that happening. Even you don't see Marco Rubio talks the way that he wants. Donald Trump talks the way he wants. And you see some sort of chaos, if you put it. Are they gonna bring all these forces, all these mindsets together to reach a unity, some sort of unity toward what's going on with Iran, or we're gonna see the same sort of chaos that we've seen so far?
I think chaos is the is what we're gonna see out of the Trump administration. First of all, to avoid chaos, you have to have systems in place for policy coordination. That's normally the way things have operated the last couple of decades. A strong national security advisor at the head of a strong national security council. If you've seen over the course of years, the growth of the National Security Council, you start with Kissinger, a very small group, and you go up, and each presidency seems to expand the size of the National Security Council. Trump was betrayed by the National Security Council in his first presidency. If you go back to Alexander Vindman, who was, you know, on the NSC staff and coordinating with Ciarello, the CIA asset, Trump doesn't trust the National Security Council structure. He feels that he was betrayed by it. So this time around, you know, Trump also early on, you know, he had to fire, I think it was Michael Waltz, the national security advisor, because Waltz was doing his own thing, which is something Trump always fears out of the National Security Council. So now you have Marco Rubio dual-hatted. This is a horrible thing. It's constitutionally questionable whether or not he can do that, because as the national security advisor, he works for the president, is not held accountable to Congress. But as the Secretary of State, having been, ratified by the Senate, he's responsible to the Senate. They can summon him in. And so now now Rubio can just decide, am I advising the president as Secretary of State, or am I advising the president as National Security Council? Henry Kissinger is the only other person that had that kind of strength, and he himself recognized the constitutional limitations of this. But the other thing is that the State Department is downsizing. I mean, you saw they fired 1,300 some odd staffers. Many of them came from the Intelligence Bureau. They were fired. Why? Well, because, gosh, they have opinions. They represent the permanent bureaucracy of people who have inherited policies from previous administrations, and their job is to keep those policies going in a relatively consistent manner. Trump doesn't want to do that. He wants to have his own policies. So they've gutted the State Department. The National Security Council is dysfunctional, almost non-existent, in the role that it plays. there is no structure of policy coordination. And as a result, policies tend to be made in a very knee-jerk reaction by the president. And if anything, the National Security Council then backfills and works with, but there's no, normally the president in a meeting will say something. The National Security Advisor will then hold a principals meeting and say, you know, the president had said this, I need you to go back and, you know, start developing thoughts on it. We're going to turn it over to our, my deputy, and you guys need to delegate. And the deputies meetings now will take over the interagency coordination process. And they get together, they break down, and they create working groups, and people get into these working groups, and they start to discuss things. They share it, they write up papers, staff it back and forth till it gets briefed up to the deputies level. And the deputies go, we got something. They convene the principals. They say they got something. They take it to the president. Now they have policy. Everybody agrees on it. That ain't happening right now. The president just makes his own damn decision and everybody's playing catch up. So they flip the script and it's dysfunctional. So I don't see anybody coming together on Iran anytime soon. They will all be prisoner to the whim of the president. That's the case of Ukraine as well.
Two cases are happening in the United States. The case of Epstein and Russiagate. It's coming out, and Tulsi Gabbard was talking about it. Do you feel these two cases are against each other? Somehow they're fighting each other, the two sides?
It'd be easy to see that, except then you have to, if you take a look at the roots of each one. I think Epstein is a huge political problem for this president, and not a political problem. Again, I could be proven wrong. I don't know. I don't think the president is guilty of anything involving Epstein, except bad judgment. The problem the president has is that the Epstein file, it's not a file in the classic sense, we'll just call it the file in terms of the concept of Epstein and what he was doing, is highly likely is an Israeli intelligence collection operation built around sexual blackmail of the worst kind. And if the truth gets out, it could permanently damage U.S.-Israeli relations. In fact, it could make it impossible for us to have normal relations with the state of Israel. And given the power of the Israeli lobby, there's just pressure on the United States to make this thing go away. I mean, this is why you see Pam Bondi now. I guess she's going to go meet with, Ghislaine Maxwell and, maybe even Congress is going to call it. I think they're just looking at a way to bring out the one person and try to whitewash this whole thing and make it go away so they don't have to talk. They don't have to mention the state of Israel. Tulsi Gabbard's efforts at declassification, you know, having been involved in the intelligence community and knowing what it takes to declassify documents, I understand that she's only been DNI for 6 months to try and declassify top secret documents and things of that nature. It's a lengthy process. And so I just see the timeline for declassification being consistent with, you know, the product that she's produced. And I think it was developed independently of the Epstein problem. That's my opinion. It could be that she accelerated it because someone said, hey, that thing you were getting ready to release last month or next month, could you release it now? Who knows? But I think that, you know, this, because this is being referred to for criminal prosecution, I think it's a tighter investigation than simply saying, oh, let's do this because we have problems with Epstein. We need to release something. I think the two are separate.
Today, I talked with Mirandy Scott. He said that Iran somehow is prepared. Iran is prepared to defend itself against Israel. And they expect that Israel is going to attack Iran again. Yeah. But looking at Israel and their attack And if we put ourselves in the Israelis in their shoes and to understand what would be their attitude, what would be their policy, what they're going to gain from any sort of attack. I don't see that coming. They're coming out of a new war with Iran in the Middle East that it doesn't seem that would be beneficial for the state of Israel, for the administration, for even for Netanyahu himself.
Well, Netanyahu has long positioned Iran to be the greatest existential threat to Israel, and using the nuclear Iran's nuclear program as the justification. I think the Israelis have bought into a policy of regime change, and I think the United States has voiced its support of this policy. And so this becomes an existential struggle, something that Netanyahu has been trying to get a long time. You know, he's finally been able to get the United States to bomb Iran. That's something he wanted a long time ago. It may not have been exactly what he wanted, but I think that Professor Mirandi is 100% correct. I think there will be a continuation of this conflict. What Israel's, Israel gave up a couple very valuable resources to strike Iran this time in an effort to achieve regime change. I understand that's what they were trying to do, and they failed. They gave up a program that was at least 10 years old of deploying these drone factories into Iran. We don't know the extent to which these drones have been cleaned up by the Iranians. There was a story in the Iranian press. I don't know if it's just done for propaganda purposes, of the thief that broke into a home and found a drone factory and called in the cops and said, "I'm a thief. I broke in, but I have to report what I've seen." I mean, that could just be a story, but the point is, if it's true, that means there's still capability resident inside Iran to carry out the kind of drone attacks that frustrated the Iranians in the last conflict. The other thing that the Israelis gave up was this, the ability to fly out to the Caspian Sea and hit Tehran coming out of the Caspian Sea. I think the Iranians now are developing the ability to deploy very capable combat aircraft over the Caspian Sea and a combat air patrol to prevent that ever happening again. So in order for there to be another conflict, Israel would have to have other cards up their sleeves, other approaches to this battlefield that would take the Iranians by surprise. And the fact that Israel seems to be hell-bent on having a follow-on conflict with Iran means that I think the Israelis may have other surprises for the Iranians. The unprecedented penetration of the Iranian intelligence services by the Israelis is something that should scare them out of the Iranian leadership. I mean, the assassination attempt that took place against Pezeshkian on June 15th means that they had knowledge that the Supreme National Security Council meeting had been scheduled for a specific time and the specific location. And then they also had knowledge of the technical aspects, the design aspects of the building, because they attempted what they called the Nasrallah solution, which was to blow up all the exits and have the people die of, Nasrallah wasn't blown up. He died of asphyxiation because all of the exits where the bunker he was in were sealed off and he couldn't breathe. That's what they tried to do to Pezeshkian and the others. The amount of intelligence involved in that is, unreal. And that shows a deep penetration of the Iranian security mechanisms. Has Iran rooted all that out, solved those problems? I don't know. But I think the fact that the Israelis are so aggressive on this, there's other tricks. If I were the Iranians, I'd be very concerned about cyber penetration. We know that the United States, back in the Stuxnet area, was working on a follow-on virus. I can't remember the new Zeus or something of that nature. That takes control of all of the infrastructure, the ability to turn on and off traffic lights, to shut down electricity, to create chaos and sow confusion. is there a death switch the Israelis can hit, you know, the second time around that shuts down Iran? Has Iran solved that problem? It's a big gamble for Israel, because the one thing we know is that the Israelis haven't solved the Iranian ballistic missile problem, and that whatever punches Israel plans on delivering, Iran is now prepared to, you know, engage using a higher caliber missile force. That Iran has absorbed the lessons of this conflict. We saw over the course of the conflict, their ability to penetrate Iranian air defenses increased as the war went on. They developed greater sophistication in their attacks, and they started to deploy more advanced weapon systems. So I'd imagine that the Iranians would be able to achieve the same level of penetration of the Israeli ballistic missile defense system to bring punishing blows against Israel quicker than before. And so it becomes a race to see who can knock who out. Very dangerous situation, but I do agree with Professor Mirandi that the Israelis haven't backed off of their plan. Why do they do it? Because Netanyahu's political future depends on him being able to posture himself as a wartime president, the only man capable of defeating Iran and securing Israel.
Scott, just to wrap up this session, how do you find the case of Gaza? 25 countries, somehow they're criticizing Israel for what they're doing in Gaza. But when it comes to the reality of what's going on, nobody seems to do something substantial, do something practical in terms of forcing Netanyahu and his administration, Israelis, to accept something in Gaza. You look at the scenes, videos, pictures, it's unbelievable what's going on there.
Look, I said this a long time ago. I may have said it with you. The saturation factor, the exhaustion factor. The Israelis have saturated death, Gazan death, across the global airwaves to the point where the world just wakes up every morning expecting that it's normal that 200 Gazan civilians will have been killed, many of them women and children. We're no longer shocked by seeing dismembered children. We're not shocked by Israeli snipers shooting innocent people. We're not shocked by any of this. It just becomes the background noise. And the concept of genocide, likewise, it no longer has meaning, the word, because it's been used so often with no consequence. To the point where the world accepts that Israel is committing genocide, and yet, because of the saturation, we're not shocked by it. We just continue to go on. The indifference of the world to the suffering of the Palestinian people. And it's one of the great tragedies of what's happening right now, the absolute indifference. It's like we're watching, you know, instead of seeing reality, it's almost as if we're watching reality TV. It's entertainment. And there's a certain genre of film that are designed to shock people and scare people. And that's what's happening here. I mean, this is tragic. It disgusts me. It sickens me. But what do you do when you're confronted with a world that collectively has no conscience? None whatsoever. And, you know, I also, if you recall, warned people. They said, oh, man, we need Hezbollah to come in. I said, no, you don't. Because the second Hezbollah comes in, you got a different conflict with other people dying. It'll steal the show because it's fresher. It's different. You mean dead Lebanese? Well, that's new. Let's look at dead Lebanese. We're tired of looking at dead Gazans. We've seen that film before. And now we have Syria falling apart. They're shooting Druze. We got videos of Druze being gunned down as they're. Let's see that. That's really cool. That's interesting. We haven't seen that before. Because we're tired of seeing dead Lebanese and dead Gazans. I mean, this is the perversity of the human condition, where, you know, we have made death so normal, so utterly normal, that we forget how horrible it is. You know, Hind Rajab should have brought tears to everybody's eyes, but there's a freaking 20 Hind Rajabs dying a day in Gaza right now. And we're just saturated with it. And there's, you know, I don't know how to defend what's happening in the world today. I can't defend it. I can't defend what's happening in my country. The fact that we continue to facilitate this or allow this to legitimize this. Europe has lost all conscience. There's nothing there. They continue to say that they object to this. I mean, Kalia Kallas has came out and said, you know, if you don't stop, we're going to do something. What are you going to do? Nothing. China, at least, has come out and said the continued killing of Gazan civilians is going to compel, and nothing happening in the West is going to compel China to do things that the West will never expect China to do. I don't know what that is, because China doesn't have the capacity to militarily intervene. But at least China might be waking up with a conscience to do this. But come on, Nima, this sickens me. It sickens me. I mean, I don't know what to do. You know, wrap a kafir around me and go out and demonstrate. Yay, I'm one of tens of thousands to do that, and nothing has happened. Write another article. I could do that, but that's just one of many articles that has been written. Lobby? Lobby for what? Congress doesn't care. The pro-Israeli lobby has such firm control over the Congress that Congress can just ignore this. We criminalize dissent. We criminalize, you know, anybody who speaks out against Israel. America is dysfunctional in this regard. So is Europe. And as a result, this tiny genocidal country of Israel gets away with literal murder. The only way the Israelis are held to account is by the bravery of Hamas. The only way. Every day, Hamas scores another victory against the Israeli occupation forces. And that's ultimately what's going to bring this war to an end, is the courageous resistance of Hamas. And tragically, the stoic resilience of the Palestinian people who will refuse to bend the knee and yield as they're being starved to death, bombed to death, beaten to death. I mean, I could go on forever. It's just because I don't know what to say. I mean, that's the truth. I don't know what to say because words can't do any of this justice. Words are meaningless. You know, what's needed is action. What's needed is the Egyptian army to mobilize and move into the Negev and take over Dimona. What's needed is the Jordanians to make a thrust out of the West Bank into Jerusalem and seize Jerusalem. What's needed is Turkey to come driving through Syria and capture Tel Aviv. What's needed is for the Israeli nation to be removed from the face of the earth. That's what's needed, because Israel is a cancer on the Middle East and on the world. And if you don't believe that, then you're ignorant. There's no way you can sit there and justify what Israel has become. Listen to the words of the Israelis themselves, even those who want the hostages removed. They don't want to stop. They majority of them believe it's okay to continue to kill the Gazans. The majority of Israelis believe it's okay to continue doing this. Israelis are saying that there is no such thing as a civilian. Hell, Alan Dershowitz is saying that on American TV. There's no such thing as a civilian. There's no such thing as an innocent civilian. My God, Alan, there are. You know, and I talked to Alan. He talked about having compassion. There's no compassion there because we've eliminated the status of civilian. Therefore, everything's a legitimate military target. You have Israeli ministers that say, we'll kill everybody. And yet the world allows them to exist. Now, the only solution is to eliminate Israel. And the world's not ready to do that. And what will it take? And sadly, I think that the world will be willing to let all the Palestinians die before they take any action against Israel, because we've just become immune to Palestinian death. One day we'll wake up and they won't be there.
Just not to be in this sort of mood. Scott, do you feel that the case of Syria is somehow going the way that Israel wanted it to be, or the situation is somehow much more complicated? You see the factions within the Druze community.
It was always complicated, Nima. It was always complicated. It's just like Iraq was always complicated. Saddam Hussein held Iraq together, understood the complexities. If you go in and take a look at the Ba'ath you know, I didn't have a chance to go through the totality of Ba'ath Party documentation, but I reviewed enough of it while I was a weapons inspector there. The way that Saddam Hussein had organized Iraq was designed to bring the factions together, to simplify things, to streamline things. It was actually fairly democratic in terms of empowerment of minorities, et cetera. And then we removed him and Iraq fell apart into these factions, et cetera. Syria is the same thing. I mean, the Syrian Ba'athist Party was a glue that held it together. Imperfectly, but it held it together, seeking to streamline and simplify and get rid of these. But you remove Bashar al-Assad without a plan, without a plan. And what you brought in was al-Qaeda, whose only plan is violence. And this was inevitable. I said it from day one. This is what's going to happen. It doesn't take anybody by surprise who studied Syria, who knows Syria, just those dreamers who thought, oh, no, this is okay. This is fine. Everything will be okay. It won't be okay. Because there's no such thing as a singularity of votes. The Druze have different factions. The Shia have different factions. The Sunnis have different factions. What is ISIS in Syria? People tend to forget that the majority of the ISIS fighters that fought for ISIS were Syrian tribal people. Yes, they brought in the foreigners, but at the end of the day, it was the ability of ISIS to take advantage of the dysfunction of the Syrian government, the dislocation of Syrian power, to exploit the vacuum, to go into the Bedouin tribes and recruit the Bedouin tribes and make them part of that, which led to the massive expansion into Anbar, similar things, Arab Bedouin tribes moving into the Tikrit region through Mosul. That's what made ISIS work. And ISIS, at the end of the day, is an ideology that thrives in a vacuum. What is Syria today? A vacuum. So what do you see? You see the resurgence. You're seeing the resurgence of ISIS again, because they thrive off of this lack of central authority. The Bedouin tribes of Syria is the basic recruiting ground of ISIS. And you're going to see a resurrection of this. They may call it something different, but it's going to be reborn, and that's just going to lead to more death and destruction, because ISIS can't exist with anything other than pure Wahhabist Sunni fundamentalism. So they'll kill the Druze, they'll kill the Shia, they'll kill the Alawites, they'll kill the Christians. That's Syria right now. It's the killing fields, literally the killing fields. It's not good for Israel. It's not good for anybody. It's just, it's a tragedy. But it's entertaining as hell. I mean, come on, we get to watch different kinds of ways of people dying. You know, all the sickos out there that you'll wake up every morning, look at these videos and all this stuff. I mean, I scroll through them, but I stopped watching. I'm just tired of watching people die, because it's meaningless. I mean, it'd be one thing if you watch death and you say, okay, rally around, let's go in, let's take care. That's what America should be doing. You remember when Donald Trump fired the cruise missiles into Syria in 2018 because the white helmets exploited falsified videotapes of people, of children being decontaminated who weren't really, we care. We saw this. The human suffering was such that we had to respond. Why aren't you looking at the videos of the Druze men being forced to jump off of balconies where the families lined up and gunned down? Why aren't you looking at that, Donald Trump, and make a decision, oh my God, we can't allow this to happen, and send American military power in there. Kill Jolani. Kill Jolani. Kill Jolani. Give him the death sentence he deserves. Kill every single one of these ISIS head-chopping idiots that are running around there. If you're on a videotape murdering civilians, that's an automatic death sentence. Automatic. Capture them, put them against the wall, shoot them. Kill them all. That's the only way to finish this, is to kill all of these head-chopping murderers instead of legitimizing them. But that's not what's going to happen. Instead, we're going to play stupid games and we're going to win stupid prizes. And the only people are going to suffer are the people of Syria, or what was formerly called Syria. The solution may be Turkey. I don't know. Maybe the Turks can come in and bring some order to this. You know, one thing I know about the Turks is that they'll have no hesitation in killing people that they feel are, I mean, they've committed horrible crimes against the Kurds because they view the Kurds as terrorists. And maybe if the Turks turned on HTS and treated them that way, you could eradicate it. But Turkey's got a big problem, because you know, a large part of HTS are these Turkic peoples that have come in from the Uyghurs and the Uzbeks and everybody who's coming from Central Asia who are there now, tens of thousands of them with families, women and children. What do you do with that? We, you know, we created a nightmare. Bashar al-Assad held this dysfunctional fake state together because Syria is always a dysfunctional fake state. Manufactured Sykes-Picot, draw lines on a map, fake, put in a Hashemite king. The Ba'athist Party was the logical reaction to this to try and bring these things together. And yet we declared war on Ba'athism and we declared war on Bashar al-Assad and we finally got rid of him. And now we're paying the price. And the same thing in Iraq. Iraq is a dysfunctional state. Can we come up with something positive to talk about? Because this is about as depressing as it gets, yeah, man.
Yeah, nothing positive coming up these days. Yeah. Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Thanks. And hopefully next time we can find something positive to talk about. Yeah. Have a great day.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.